You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Chris Chandeville for the Commonwealth as the appellant in this case. In Black v. Commonwealth, this Court affirmed the defendant's conviction for attempted burglary, primarily based on evidence that he was present outside of that home during the time the attempt was made, and based on the fact finder's ability to reject his proposed explanation for his presence there. In this case, the evidence at trial proved that the defendant, Mr. Mosley, was present outside of one of the homes that was burglarized during the window of time in which it was burglarized. He gave no explanation for his presence there at any point before trial, during trial, or since trial. And then secondly, the evidence proved that stolen property from that house, in addition to stolen property from a second house, was later discovered in a vehicle that Mosley had been known to drive for an extended period of time, commingled in the center console of that vehicle with his Virginia identification card and with his library card. In addition to those facts, the evidence also proved that Mr. Mosley was found in the vicinity of a third attempted burglary and that he had gloves in his pocket, and the officer's testimony was that those gloves appeared to be the type of heavy-knit freezer gloves that grocery store workers use when they're dealing with frozen foods. And his explanation for those gloves is that they were his workout gloves. Based on the combination considered together of all of the evidence against Mr. Mosley, if Black versus Commonwealth is to continue to remain good law in Virginia, Mr. Mosley's convictions must be affirmed.
But Black doesn't cover the second burglary. It arguably covers the first burglary in spades, but how do you close the loop on the second burglary?
I think that defense counsel at trial was asked about whether or not you could close that loop. The trial court asked defense counsel, would you concede, first of all, that the same person who committed the burglary of the home also committed the larceny? She said, yes, I would concede that. And then the second question was, would you also concede that the same person who committed the first set of offenses also committed the second set of offenses? And her answer was, I think it's possible to make that conclusion. That is a conclusion that could be drawn.
But that's different from I concede, yes, that the first burglar was the second burglar. Just saying, yeah, it's possible. That's different from reasonable doubt.
Well, I think it's different maybe at the trial level, but once you get to appeal, the question is, could a reasonable fact finder have made that connection, have drawn that conclusion? And by conceding, yes, I think you could make that conclusion, on appeal, that concession is really dispositive because it concedes that a reasonable fact finder could have made that
conclusion.
Wouldn't that
conclusion have to be supported by evidence beyond a reasonable doubt?
It would, Your Honor. And I think the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, there was more than sufficient evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. The fact that his identification cards were mixed together with stolen property from both homes in the center console, if you connect him to the first burglary and conclude that he stole that property, and then that the property eventually ended up in the center console of a car he was known to drive, once you made that connection, it's certainly reasonable to conclude.
Suppose he was only indicted for the second burglary, not the first burglary, and all the facts of the case were identical. Would the evidence be sufficient?
If all the facts were identical, then yes, the facts would be sufficient. It doesn't matter whether he was indicted for one or the other. The facts come in.
We don't have
presence
at the scene. We don't have contemporaneous access. All we have is a pretty powerful coincidence, but nonetheless a coincidence later that it's all balled up together in the console of his car.
But we also have if he'd only been indicted for the second burglary, not the first one, and yet the evidence as to the first burglary had come in and was admissible for any consideration by the fact finder, then the fact finder could have made the same inferences and drawn the same conclusions as to the second burglary that the fact finder is entitled to draw when he's charged for both. That evidence is still permissible for the second, to be considered for the second burglary.
But the power of the evidence for the first burglary is the officer drives by as the guy's pulling away.
Correct,
about the time.
Correct.
There's no drive-by at the time of the second burglary.
There's not. But once you've concluded that he committed the first burglary and that he stole the property from that home and then placed it in that center console of that car, which are reasonable inferences based on his connections to the vehicle and the property being mingled together with his identifying documents, when you then co-mingle with the stolen property from the first home, the stolen property from the second home, and co-mingle the stolen property from the second home with his identifying documents, it is a fair inference to conclude that the same person committed both of those offenses. And that by co-mingling the stolen property together, it implies that once you've concluded he placed stolen property from the first home in that console, it's a fair inference to conclude he placed the stolen property from the second home in the exact same place. In addition to that, one of the primary errors I would contend that the Court of Appeals made in this case is to not consider this case, the Court of Appeals' failure to consider this case in light of the hypotheses of innocence that the defendant offered at trial. The defendant only offered really two primary hypotheses of innocence. The first is that someone else might have dumped this stolen property in this vehicle and then abandoned it there. The second is that maybe Mr. Mosley sold this car to someone else, and someone else was driving the car on this day, and someone else kind of abandoned the vehicle with the stolen property inside in the parking lot. The trial court in this case made a factual finding that because the identifying documents were commingled in the center console with the stolen property, he concluded no one came by and just dumped stolen property on top of the identifying documents because of the way that they're mixed up together. That factual finding is not plainly wrong, and it supports the trial court's rejection of those two hypotheses of innocence. On top of that is the well-accepted principle of law that people don't abandon valuable contraband in a place where anyone can get access to it. In this particular case, both victims' families testified that the stolen property was valued at between $5,000 and $6,000. So $10,000 worth of stolen property by the defendant's theory just dumped in this car sitting in a parking lot with the windows down and the keys inside, and then whoever dumped it there just left the car until the car was eventually towed. In order to rule in Mr. Mosley's favor, this court would have to hold that no reasonable trial court could reject that theory of innocence. That cannot be the case. It's perfectly reasonable.
Is it about the court rejecting a theory of innocence, or is it about the Commonwealth proving the elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt?
This court has stated that those are two sides of the same coin. So those are two ways of looking at the same question. And so one way of answering that question is to consider all the positive evidence, the affirmative evidence in the record of the defendant's guilt, which I've done in my brief. Another way of looking at the question is to consider, okay, what are the hypotheses of innocence offered by the defendant? The only two hypotheses of innocence that were preserved are that someone else dumped the property in this car and then left it, or that the true owner left the car and abandoned it until it eventually got towed, with stolen property sitting inside, the windows down, and the keys inside. And again, both of those hypotheses could have been reasonably rejected by the trial court. And while it's true, this court held in Avent that there's no responsibility for a defendant to put on evidence or to make an argument in his defense at the trial level, trial courts and appellate courts in particular cannot supply evidence where the evidence is lacking.
But does the inference that you're making, which is supported in law, but does the inference you're making strong enough to go to the burglary or only strong enough to go to receipt of stolen goods?
I think it's
for the property of the second burglary.
Well, again, the clearest concession, I think, in the record is that the same person who committed the larceny in each case also committed the burglary in each case.
Yes. If that is interpreted as a true concession of fact to the fact finder, that closes the loop with or without any additional evidence.
It does, Your Honor. And I don't mean to imply that I'm relying entirely on that concession, because I do think there's more than sufficient evidence in this case. But the point that I'd like to make as the hypothesis of innocence, it's true that there's no burden on the defendant to make an argument as to his innocence at the trial level, and it cannot be used against him at the trial level. However, his failure to proffer hypotheses of innocence at the trial level to explain the evidence against him certainly does affect and undermine his attempt to prevail on appeal, because this court has repeatedly held he's limited to the arguments he made below. The two hypotheses of innocence that he presented only went to the presence of the stolen property in the car. He never presented a hypothesis of innocence as to what he was doing outside the Winsley's home at the time that burglary occurred. So the only conclusion that this court is left with is that the only explanation for his presence there is because he committed the crime inside. Once the court concludes that he committed the crime inside, that he took the stolen property from that home and placed it in the center console with its identifying documents, it is a reasonable inference to conclude that the stolen property from the second home got to that center console in this very same way. There is no other reasonable explanation. There's no other explanation that, as a matter of law, the trial court had to accept as to how he could have been innocent of either of those two sets of crimes. I see I have 5 minutes remaining. I'll attempt to reserve 3 minutes of my time. I'd like to finally just move to the other. I've identified, I think, four or five errors in the Court of Appeals opinion in this case. One of the other most egregious errors, in my opinion, is the way the Court of Appeals individually analyzed each aspect, each circumstance of Mr. Mosley's guilt, and then dismissed each circumstance one by one. The court first examined the evidence of the stolen property in the car and concluded, well, no one saw him driving the car around the time the property was found, so that evidence is not sufficient. It's suspicious, but it's not sufficient to prove he's guilty. Then they moved on to the evidence that he was seen outside the home at the time it was burglarized. And the Court of Appeals said, well, that evidence is suspicious, but by itself, Captain Candy didn't testify what car he was in, so she couldn't connect him to the stolen property later discovered in the car. So his presence there is not enough by itself, so that's not sufficient. Then moved to the testimony about the gloves in his pocket and said, well, that is suspicious for sure, but by itself, it's not enough to conclude that he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That is exactly the type of divide and conquer approach that this court has held an appellate court cannot engage in. The question has to be, considering all of these facts together in light of each other, what inferences can a reasonable fact finder have made? So considering his connections to the car where the stolen property was located, in connection with his presence outside the home where one of those crimes occurred, what reasonable inference can be drawn from considering those facts together? And again, I would contend that the most reasonable explanation, even though this is not the standard on appeal, really the most reasonable explanation for all the evidence in this case is that Mr. Mosley committed both sets of crimes in this case. And for this reason, the Commonwealth is asking the court to reverse the Court of Appeals opinion and to affirm his convictions. And I'll retain the remainder of my time.
May it please the court, I'm Dan Mazzio representing Mr. Mosley this afternoon. The unanimous panel of the Court of Appeals determined in their opinion that the evidence was insufficient. Commonwealth contends that they came to that conclusion using a flawed analysis, and more specifically they contend that the Court of Appeals improperly applied the standard of review. They refused to consider evidence of Mr. Mosley's guilt, that they relied on an impermissible hypothesis of innocence, and that they considered each piece of evidence in isolation. I think if you look closely at what was actually decided by the Court of Appeals, I think that is contrary to the opinion.
May I interrupt you there? At page 135, where the Commonwealth has identified what is stated as a concession, if you have it handy, it reads, the court, sitting as a bench trial fact finder, not as a trial judge presiding over a jury, the fact finder judge says, let me see if I can break this down. Do you concede it's a reasonable inference that first, the person who stole the property in each case committed the burglary in each case? Answer, yes, sir. Do you think it's reasonable inference that the same person committed both? Less strong, but both. Answer is certainly possible, Your Honor. I think it's a conclusion that could be drawn. If a trial judge sitting as fact finder hears that, wouldn't it be reasonable for the fact finder to conclude that that issue of sufficiency is not in play in this case? I need to find out whether or not either of these happened, because the defense counsel has said there's not going to be a distinction made in the sufficiency analysis. Why would that not be reasonable for a bench trial judge to interpret it that way?
Well, Your Honor, the first of this court certainly doesn't have to agree with that concession of trial counsel.
Well, no, if a concession is made, we can't reverse a trial judge for accepting a concession of defense counsel. There may be a habeas later, but it's not something we do on direct appeal.
I might argue, Judge, I'm not certain that it's explicit that the trial judge then agreed and made his ruling explicitly for that particular reason. I understand that the court's question.
The trial judge directed a very specific question, seeing the weakness in the evidence, to the defense counsel, even distinguishing the question that the evidence on one is strong, the evidence on two is not as strong. And the answer, I think, Commonwealth argues, that the trial judge fact finder heard was, look, it's all or nothing. It's both or none. I'm not sure why that's not reasonable. Please argue it's not.
I would take the position that, first of all, the evidence is insufficient on both sets of events, the first burglary and larceny, and then the second as well.
Assume hypothetically it's sufficient on one for purposes of my question.
Well, I think there's certainly no argument that I would suggest they're both insufficient, but certainly the second is even less sufficient than I would take the position that the first is. I think that the trial court acknowledges that in their question, even referencing it as being less so or less significant of an inference.
Well, assume for the purpose of my question, one is sufficient. You're not conceding anything in responding. That the sufficiency for one is clear under the standard. Sufficiency for two is in play, but the fact finder asked if it was in play and was told not if you find the same person for one. Is that a reasonable interpretation of a trial judge sitting as fact finder from hearing that colloquy that the trial judge initiated?
And I think trial counsel says something along the lines of you could draw that conclusion. And I think that puts my argument would be that puts the ball back in the court. The ball back in the court of the trial judge to make the determination there. I understand the court's question, but I would suggest that is not necessarily binding on this court's decision.
What exactly was the concession that you understood being made in that quote, that an inference can be drawn by the court?
I think what was clearly conceded by the record was the same person that committed the larceny probably the same person that committed the burglary, and I think trial counsel conceded that fairly easily. The second question was, is it a reasonable, and I'm sorry, I'll read here specifically. Court says, do you think it's a reasonable inference that the same person committed both? Less strong, but both. And I think trial counsel's answer is it's a conclusion that could be drawn. So I might draw a distinction as to whether or not that was actually a concession. I think, however, pointing back to the error alleged by Commonwealth here as it relates to the Court of Appeals.
Let me stop you right there. Maybe it's not a concession of the ultimate issue, but it appears to be a concession that, Judge, if you want to draw it, there's sufficient evidence to do it.
So they make a concession concerning sufficiency of the evidence, which is a legal question.
Well, I think, though, what we're doing here is parsing out the two events, and I think trial counsel was, of course, in no way concluding or suggesting that the evidence was sufficient at that point. It was, in fact, they had made this motion to set aside the evidence at the time. So I think to try and...
But the question is not whether he's saying it is sufficient. The question is he arguing it's insufficient? Because if he's not arguing it's insufficient, it may be insufficient. But if a motion strike's not made, if a J&OV's not made, et cetera, et cetera. So the question is, what is the sufficiency argument that's being made to the trial judge? Obviously, the trial judge can do what he or she wants to do, but if it's not being made, the trial judge can't be faulted for not making it. That's the question I'm asking you.
If I understand the question correctly, I think there was an acknowledgement that the conclusion could be drawn at the time that the trial court was making its determination.
And the trial judge did. And having already said that you can draw that conclusion, there's
a problem. It's always difficult to try and parse out implicit conclusions by a trial court, but I think it's even more difficult in this case because the argument throughout the entirety of the trial, both in the trial itself and then later as the motion to set aside came, was about whether or not the inference applied. Everything at the trial court level, from all the argument and the judge's ruling, seemed to be surrounding and hinging on whether or not the inference applied to the larceny and the burglary. I might suggest that if we were reading that inferentially, that we would perhaps see that everyone was in agreement at that point that if but for the inference, that this case would be insufficient. I think that was the finding of the Court of Appeals. But as the judge is attempting to make these determinations and these questions are being asked, I think it has to be looked at in the light of the fact that that was the question for which they were seeking to ascertain an answer to.
But if the counsel at trial had said, no, Judge, you can't draw that, would you agree that we can draw this inference? Answer, yes, he did. Here's your problem. Would you agree that you could draw this inference? Answer, no, you're home free. That's all I'm trying to suggest to you. It's not that they said it was a concession that the same person did it. They're saying that you may draw that inference on this evidence.
I think that's what trial counsel indicated at the time, was that it was possible to draw that conclusion. Yes.
All right. Go ahead.
I think, Your Honor, that the Commonwealth's position is very specific as it relates to the Court of Appeals decision and what error they have alleged. I don't believe that the Commonwealth is suggesting, at least as I read the assignment of error, that this was a situation where the Court of Appeals had the right law, they had the right facts, they did the correct analysis, and they just came to the wrong conclusion. The assignment of error is very specific in that the suggestion is that the standard of review was implied improperly, first of all. I don't think that there's any suggestion in the court's opinion that that's the case. I think they lay out very clearly the standard of review. I don't think that there has been suggested that the standard of review cited is incorrect in any way.
But the way the analysis reads like they looked at every incriminating fact and judged it in isolation in terms of this suspiciousness, as opposed to an aggregate, which is the standard court.
I understand that that's the Commonwealth's position. However, I think that they're specifically on page 11 of the Court of Appeals opinion, walks through the fact that they recognize that the combination of the evidence that they're looking at, they walk through the evidence one at a time, I think quite obviously, because that's the only way you can make a conclusion about the totality of the evidence, is to examine each piece one at a time and then make a conclusion about the totality. I don't think it's possible to do a written analysis any other way. I think the fact that the Court of Appeals references that they're aware that they must be considered in the totality, they walk through them, and then they make the determination that under the standard of review and the applicable law that the evidence is insufficient, I think suggests that they did exactly that. I don't know that there's any way to, other than pure speculation, to determine that that was not the process that was gone through. Additionally, I think I want to touch on the Commonwealth's discussion of the Black case. I would disagree with the Commonwealth's contention that the fact that the Black case exists suggests that Mr. Mosley's presence pulling off of the curb in that location of that first burglary is somehow conclusive and cannot be escaped from in any possible way. I disagree with that position because the Black case was very different for two different reasons. The first was that in the Black case, Black was standing on the front porch of a home that had just been attempted to be burglarized. We don't have that in this case. We have, during a window, at least five-hour window, Mr. Mosley was seen. You believe the testimony of the officer who testified about seeing him there inside of the home, that he was pulling off the curb out in front of that home. I think that is an extremely different set of facts than what we had in Black. It was also, in the Black case, it also was that the defendant in that case testified at trial. I think the court also held that there was a great deal of weight placed on the fact that the trial court was free to disregard or disbelieve the testimony at trial as it related to his presence there. We, of course, don't have that here. Mr. Mosley does not testify. There is not an explanation as to presence. I think if the Commonwealth's logic stands, then solely Mr. Mosley being there pulling off of the curb during that time period of burglary would be sufficient in and of itself to establish that he had been the person who committed that larceny and burglary. That's the way I see the Commonwealth's logic as they argue that point, and I would strongly disagree that just because a person is in a vehicle at curbside during a five-hour window when a crime is committed, that you can draw an inference that that person must have been the one that committed the crime. I think that the facts and circumstances of Black are very specific, that they perhaps do lend themselves to that conclusion, but I think this case does not do so. I also wanted to discuss the Commonwealth's allegation of error that the Court of Appeals relied on an impermissible hypothesis of innocence. And I would suggest, Your Honors, that the Commonwealth's argument is very, very specific. On brief, they walk through each of the different suggestions or issues or pieces of evidence that arose at trial and want to talk about and apply the hypothesis of innocence to them individually. I would suggest it's much more simple than that, in that Mr. Mosley contended from the beginning that he was not the person who committed these crimes. That was the position taken by his counsel at motion to strike. When they renewed the motion to strike, was the position taken when they filed their motion to set aside. It was the same position and reasonable hypothesis that the Court of Appeals relied on in their opinion. I don't think that there's a requirement of trial counsel to stop and walk through each and every, no matter how small or potentially insignificant, piece of evidence and draw a distinct and detailed explanation of why and what hypothesis may occur. I would disagree with that contention, and I would suggest that alleging and maintaining throughout that Mr. Mosley was not the person who committed these crimes, it must have been committed by someone else, is a reasonable hypothesis of innocence.
Well, I agree with you completely. But doesn't that also work on the other side, that you don't take each individual bit of evidence and decide that there's not a reasonable guilt beyond a reasonable doubt either? It's the same for you as it is for the Commonwealth.
I agree. The evidence must be viewed in the totality, and I take the Court of Appeals' position that viewed in the totality, although suspicious, that the evidence is insufficient and was insufficient at trial in order to have found Mr. Mosley guilty. The last point the Commonwealth makes in their brief, the last point of error that they allege, is that the Court of Appeals refused to consider the evidence of guilt. I would suggest that that is unreasonable based on the Court of Appeals' opinion. I think they walk through very specifically each of the pieces of evidence that may be concerning to Mr. Mosley in this case, and that they've discussed them in great detail. I'm not certain even calling them suspicious. I feel that is very clearly considering evidence of guilt, and that they, however, determined that that not was
suspicious.
I think
the Commonwealth's argument is that they considered it in isolation rather than aggregation.
I believe that both of those factors were alleged, both that it was considered in isolation as well as the fact that they refused to consider evidence of his guilt. And I would disagree on both of those points for specifically different reasons. I think that they were considered in totality, that they did consider the evidence of guilt, that they were allowed to rely on the hypothesis of innocence that was presented at trial, and that I do think that they properly applied the standard of review. Don't think the Commonwealth's position is anything other than disagreeing with the outcome.
All right, thank you very much. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Returning briefly to the question of the concession at the trial level, the purpose of a motion to strike is to argue to the fact finder that no reasonable fact finder could conclude in this case that the evidence is sufficient to convict my client. And for appeal purposes, that preserves the argument in this court that no reasonable fact finder below could have concluded the evidence was sufficient to convict my client. In this case, on page 135 of the record, when asked whether it was reasonable to conclude that the person who committed the first set of offenses also committed the second set of offenses, defense counsel conceded that is a conclusion that could be drawn. So she effectively conceded that it would be reasonable for a fact finder who's concluded that the defendant is guilty as of the first set of crimes is also going to be guilty as to the second set of crimes. Now, that still doesn't concede the argument that both convictions in totality should be reversed on appeal, but what it does concede is that if this court concludes that a reasonable fact finder could have convicted on the first set of offenses, concedes that that same reasonable fact finder could have convicted on the second set of offenses. Moving to the point made at the very end of the argument about the Court of Appeals' failure to consider affirmative evidence of Mosley's guilt, the argument is that not that the Court of Appeals failed to consider any of the evidence. The argument is that there was affirmative evidence in the record of Mosley's guilt that the Court of Appeals failed to consider specific affirmative evidence, and that's at the very end of the court's opinion, where the court considers Mr. Mosley's statement to the police officer that he had the gloves in his pocket because he used them to work out. They were his workout gloves. And as the Commonwealth argued on brief, that is a hypothesis of innocence, an explanation that the trial court could have rejected, and having rejected that, the trial court could have concluded that Mr. Mosley was lying to conceal his guilt. He was lying to conceal the real reason he had those gloves, which was to participate in these burglaries that he was committing in the area, an attempted burglary that occurred that day that he was not ultimately prosecuted for, but also that second burglary that occurred that day that he was prosecuted for.
The mistake there you're pointing to is that footnote, the last footnote that says you can only use the adverse inference if it's testimony as opposed to statements to the police, wherein we've held at least twice, as has the Court of Appeals, you can consider all statements.
Correct, Your Honor. In both Black versus Commonwealth and in Emmett versus Commonwealth, this court has held you can consider any statements that the trial court believes were untrue as affirmative evidence of the defendant's guilt. The Court of Appeals, in its opinion, in the footnotes...
Not sufficient, but evidence with other evidence that could be sufficient.
Correct, Your Honor. And the Court of Appeals just rejected that argument and cited to a case, United States versus Zafiro, which, as I pointed out on my brief, the Court of Appeals cited that case to support its proposition that only if the defendant testifies can you consider his or her false statements as evidence of guilt. But in Zafiro, the defendant did testify.
That was a Seventh Circuit case?
Yes, Your Honor. So the proposition that the Court of Appeals cited Zafiro for was never before the court in Zafiro because the defendant testified. So that is just one additional error to compound all the others. The Court of Appeals failing to consider all the evidence against Mr. Mosley. And for these reasons, we would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the trial court while reversing the Court of Appeals opinion.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.